Well, here we go with the reading of today's Wall Street Journal for this Friday, the 20th of February, 2026. And we begin the Wall Street Journal by saying hello to Steve.
Thank you, John Shea, and hello, everyone. Let's start with a review of yesterday's Wall Street activity. Stocks fall, oil rises on possible U.S. strike on Iran. Article by Crystal Herrer. Oil prices climbed and the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 260 points Thursday, with investors monitoring the U.S. military buildup in the Middle East ahead of a possible strike on Iran. The regional deployment of U.S. aircraft and naval ships raises the risk the U.S. could attack Iran's nuclear program or missile stockpile or try to topple its regime. Analysts say Iran could close the world's busiest oil thoroughfare, the Strait of Hormuz, which sees roughly 20 million barrels of petroleum running through it daily, the equivalent to almost a fifth of global oil demand. Brent crude futures, the international benchmark, rose 1.9% to settle at $71.66 a barrel Thursday, its highest closing level since late July. The Dow fell 0.5%. The S&P 500 slipped 0.3%. The NASDAQ composite also lost 0.3%. A slide in financial stocks weighed on the S&P 500, with the sector losing 0.9%, the most among the index's 11 groups. At the same time, tech stocks continued to fall after a brief reprieve earlier this week. Investors have begun to grow concerned this year that tech shares are trading at sky-high prices following a dizzying artificial intelligence rally, leading some to shift into less-loved corners of the market. Shares of Apple declined 1.4%, Alphabet fell 0.2%, and Planetair Technologies shed 0.4%. Prediction market traders made wagers tied to geopolitical tensions. As of Thursday afternoon, traders on Kalshi put a 38% probability that Iran will close the Strait of Hormuz this year. On rival platforms Polymarket, traders saw a 34% chance that Iran will close the strait by December 31st. Polymarket has a data partnership with Dow Jones, the publisher of the Wall Street Journal. Shares of Occidental Petroleum gained 9.4% after the energy's producer adjusted per share earnings surged past expectations. Deere jumped 12% after raising its fiscal year outlook. Klarna slumped 27% after it swung to a loss. And we'll check in on the stock spotlight column. There's a couple of mentions in there. Well, at least I'm hoping we do. No, we're not going to do that. We'll stay in the business and finance section of the journal today with this article. Higher beef prices are set to last. U.S. cattle herds are at its lowest level in 75 years, putting the meat in short supply. Article by Patrick Thomas. High prices are the new normal in the U.S. beef market. A tight cattle supply and continued robust demand for the protein are expected to keep costs elevated for consumers and others throughout the supply chain over the next few years. Efforts to improve slightly have been slow-moving. Ranchers are reluctant to erode their strongest profits in decades by increasing the size of the herds. As a result, the U.S. cattle herd is at its lowest level in 75 years, according to the Agricultural Department. Measures from the Trump administration to rein in prices have had little effect on the market. The Labor Department said last week that ground beef prices in January were up 17% from a year earlier, compared with a 2.1% rise for all other groceries over that time. Beef is the premium protein, and consumers' demand is reflecting that, said Monty Lesh, a rancher in Miles City, Montana, with 650 cattle. High beef prices haven't stopped shoppers such as Tony Bear, who lives in northern Kentucky. Bear, 53 years old, has noticed the higher prices at stores, but his beef buying hasn't dropped off because he loves the taste. The local Publix market is his go-to, but he said he also shops at Costco, where he plans to grill steaks for a larger group. I will pay extra for quality steaks and burgers, he said. Ranchers began shrinking their herds several years ago because of poor financial conditions stemming from the COVID-19 pandemic. A severe drought also burned up grazing pastures, making it more expensive to feed livestock. The Trump administration views easing beef prices as a priority, enlisting top advisors to find solutions in policy meetings. This month, President Trump signed an executive order to quadruple beef imports from Argentina, though the volume is small, and to drop some tariffs on imports of Brazilian beef. The administration is ginning up more beef demand, too. A recent update of the federal dietary guidelines recommend Americans consume more protein and put beef atop the new food pyramid. At a trade show in Nashville, Tennessee this month, hundreds of ranchers cheered when Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. said he eats beef twice a day. He also begged ranchers to increase the size of their herds to ease the supply strain. Consumers aren't likely to find price relief away from the supermarkets either, as high ground beef prices pressure restaurants, particularly burger chains. Burger King, Wendy's, and Jack in the Box have all said they expect beef inflation to weigh in their profits. On Thursday, steakhouse chain Texas Roadhouse said it plans to raise menu prices by around 2% in early April. On the plains of southeastern Montana, Lesh 64, like many other ranchers, began shrinking his herd several years ago when drought conditions hurt his cattle-raising operation. He used to have 900 cattle, but is reluctant to build back to that level. Rainfall has been sparse in Lesh's region of the state. Spending the money to purchase more female cattle for breeding is too big a financial gamble if grazing pastures dry up again and he has to buy more feed. Ranchers say they have been pouring their earnings into repairs, long overdue equipment purchases, and paying down their debts. Some have been spending to improve the genetics in their herds, including breeding cattle that could yield juicier steaks and possibly land them bigger paydays. Industry analysts estimate the earliest the U.S. herd could grow meaningfully is 2028. Some ranchers across the country have started to hold back their animals for breeding rather than send them to slaughter. Even so, beef industry officials say the herd is unlikely to reach levels attained prior to 2020. The age of ranchers is also a factor in herd building decisions. It doesn't make sense for ranchers to increase their herds if they don't have an heir to take over and if they plan to sell the land to retire, said Philip Perry, a rancher who has several hundred cattle in northeastern Kansas. More farmers are over the age of 75 than under 35, according to the USDA. Mark Moore, a rancher from southeastern Iowa, said he views the rest of agriculture as a cautionary tale. A glut of corn and soybeans is depressing prices, leading to steep losses for row crop farmers. Ranchers want to avoid a similar fate. Corn and soybean prices right now are suffering for a reason. We overproduced, he said. Meatpacking companies have signaled that a smaller beef supply is here to stay. Executives of some of the largest meatpacking companies are closing plants and cutting hours in preparation for a tight cattle supply for the foreseeable future. Tyson Foods in January shut its Lexington, Nebraska beef plant, one of the largest in the U.S., laying off about 3,200 workers. It also cut production in half at its larger Texas facility. Rivals JBS and Cargill have each closed smaller facilities that package beef cuts into products such as ground beef for restaurants and grocery stores. The data that we see indicates an ultimately smaller herd, Tyson Chief Operating Officer Devin Cole told analysts this month. Texas Agricultural Commissioner Sid Miller said this month that the federal government should consider tax credits for ranchers who hold back their animals for breeding rather than sending them to slaughter. In Montana, Lesh said, throwing government money at the problem won't help. You'll get people to take advantage of it, but it doesn't mean that they'll increase their cow numbers, he said. And we're going to stay in the business and finance section. It's a pretty good list of articles I think we can pull from this section. And this next one, Walmart sales climb, driven by grocery and online gains. Article by Sarah Nassauer. Walmart reported strong sales growth in its latest quarter as it continued to attract more shoppers of all income groups to its groceries and speedy online delivery. Walmart's revenue from advertising also grew, a small but fast-growing and profitable part of its businesses. U.S. comparable sales, those from stores and digital channels operating for at least 12 months, rose 4.6% in the quarter ended January 30th. Strengthened by market share gains, especially in upper-income households, the company said. Online sales in the U.S. jumped 27%, Globally, advertising revenue grew by 46% to $6.4 billion. Overall, Walmart reported net sales of $190.7 billion for the quarter ended January 31st, up 5.6% from the same period last year. That was slightly ahead of analysts' estimates of $190.5 billion, according to FactSet. Net income fell 19% to $4.2 billion. Walmart shares fell 1.4% to $124.87 on Thursday. Now, as Walmart's new chief executive officer, John Furner, takes the helm, his challenge will be maintaining years of quarterly sales growth. Walmart has shown that it could adapt its brick-and-mortar model to a changing consumer environment with more buyers moving online and shoppers hunting for lower prices, especially for groceries. Earlier this month, the company's stock surpassed a $1 trillion valuation for the first time. Ultimately, what matters is how we show up for our customers and members. Did we serve their needs better today than we did yesterday? Furness said on a call with analysts Thursday, referencing the company's turn toward technology and overall strength. On Thursday, Walmart also said consumers continue to spend cautiously, especially low-income shoppers. In the U.S., its largest business by revenue and profit, profit margins grew thanks to grocery sales, membership through its Walmart Plus program, and advertising sales. But that growth was offset by slower sales growth in general merchandise, a dynamic that reflects shoppers giving priority to their spending needs. Walmart expects steady growth in the current year, with 3.5% to 4.5% growth in net sales and operating income growth of 6 to 8% for the full year, below some analysts' expectations for the retailer's current year guidance. What we want to do at this juncture in the year is to leave ourselves maximum flexibility to operate in this environment, said Walmart Chief Financial Officer John David Rainey in an interview. The spending gap between high-income and low-income households is widening slightly, Rainey said. It is a pattern Walmart executives have noted in recent quarters, but it is accelerating, he said. Walmart defines higher-income households as those that earn over $100,000 a year. A pullback in federal government supplemental nutrition assistance program benefits has also slightly weighed on low-income spending in the most recent quarter, he said. While inflation has cooled compared with past years, prices are rising on imported items, and prices overall are still significantly elevated compared with the pandemic period, he said. And we're going to stay in the business and finance section. What to make of this weird market? This is the Streetwise column that appears regularly in the Wall Street Journal by James McIntosh. It isn't just you. The market is weird. Stocks are swinging about as though there's a full-blown crisis, while the S&P 500 is just 2% from its high. One way to measure the scale of moves is to look at sectors. The gap between the three best-performing sectors over 6 weeks and the three worst has rarely been bigger, and usually during some sort of panic. At least in data back to the mid-1990s, it is highly unusual a sector should diverge so much, yet this index stays so stable. The last time the sectors diverged this month was just before Silicon Valley Bank's collapse prompted a global banking panic and federal rescues. Before that was the rebound from the first lockdown low. And before that was during the global financial crisis of 2008 and 2009. Earlier, the dot-com bubble and its aftermath saw a series of bigger sector swings. Those who just buy the market might not even have noticed anything strange. After all, the average stock in the S&P is flirting with record highs. This year, the S&P is virtually unchanged, while the energy sector is up 22%. Consumer staples up 13%, and financials down 4%. The oddity shows up in the options market, too. The implied dispersion of stocks, how much they are expected to move relative to each other, is very high, as Tim Edwards, head of index investment strategy at S&P Dow Jones Indices, points out. Diversion of stocks has only once been high when implied volatility measured by the VIX is so low. That was in October last year, when there was a rush for big technology companies and all manner of super risky stocks popular with individual investors, before those trades went into sharp reverse. What to make of it all? There are three ways to treat such a strange market. ignore it, trade it, or panic. It isn't obvious to me how to choose between them. Ignore it. Index investors have been fine, as almost every faller is matched by a winner. Sure, there are major changes underway, so maybe we're headed back to the old days when smaller stocks and value stocks beat the market. But broadly, the economy seems fine, like a swan. The frantic paddling under the surface could combine with the index sailing on serenely. Trade it. There's big money to be made or lost betting on how the rotations in the market work out. Will AI eat the software industry, software services industry? They make up most of the worst performers this year, with losses of more than 30% for stocks such as Intuit, AppLovin, and Workday. Trucking? C.H. Robinson Worldwide tumbled 15% in a day. An Old Dominion freight line fell more than 10% from its high amid, probably overdone, worry about AI cutting them out of linking truckers and shippers directly. But the former is still up 16%, and the latter up 24% this year. Are big tech companies wildly overspending on AI? Fund managers think so, according to a Bank of America survey, and the hyperscalers are all down this year. Meanwhile, the places they spend their money soared, with SanDisk up 153%, Western Digital 72%, Teradyne 63%, and Seagate Technology 54%. It's a wonderful time to be selling stuff to data centers, but actually building them looks less attractive to investors. Thirdly, panic. There are kind of sensible explanations for all of the sector rotations, the big to small shift, the growth to value shift, but the mere fact of the swings is discombobulating for stock pickers and could push risk managers to cut back overall exposure. This can hurt the market as a whole and trigger further falls. Even though growth, earnings, and so on seem undamaged. History doesn't provide a clear recommendation. Take those previous episodes where there were huge sector shifts. In 2023, stocks were down 6 weeks after the rotation. After the pandemic, they soared as the government pumped in stimulus. In both the 2008 and 9 financial crisis and the years of dot-com boom and bust, major rotations could be followed by large gains or losses. What didn't happen is what's happened so far to the overall market. NADA, nada. It's weird, and that's what makes it so hard to respond to. And we'll continue on. An article, we always hear about what's happening in the Boeing world. Here's an article. Boeing signs $30 billion jet deals. Article by Kimberly Kao. Boeing signed deals to sell almost 100 jets to Vietnamese carriers valued at over $30 billion, signaling warming ties between the U.S. and Vietnam as trade talks continue. The deals were signed during a visit to the U.S. by head of Vietnam's Communist Party, Tho Lam, for the inaugural meeting of President Trump's Board of Peace. The aircraft maker struck a $22.5 billion deal to sell up to 40 787-9 Dreamliners to Vietnam-based carrier Sun Phu Quoc Airways. The order is the largest ever for wide-body aircraft by a Vietnamese airline and the first direct aircraft purchase by Sun Phu Quoc Airways, parent company Sun Group, said in a social media statement Thursday. The newly established privately owned Sun Phu Quoc Airways plans to expand its fleet to 100 aircraft by 2030, Sun Group said. Our partnership with Boeing establishes a strong foundation for building a world-class airline that operates in sync with the tourism and resort ecosystem Sun Group has developed, Sun Group Chairman Dang Minh Trung said in a separate statement. The deal came as flag carrier Vietnam Airlines signed an order for 50 Boeing 737 MAX jets valued at about $8 billion as part of an earlier announced U.S.-Vietnam trade pact. The carrier also plans to invest more than $12 billion in 30 wide-body Boeing aircraft, it said. Budget airline Vietjet signed a financing agreement with Griffin Global Asset Management for 6 Boeing 737-8 aircraft valued at around $965 million at list prices. And a little bit of a companion article, I'd say. Speaking of airline companies. Airbus slams supplier over engine shortage. Article by Benjamin Katz and Mauro Oru. Airbus said it would deliver fewer aircraft than expected this year because of significant shortages of Pratt and Whitney engines, issuing a sharp public rebuke of one of its largest suppliers. Shares of the European plane maker fell nearly 7% on Thursday after the company said the engine issue had forced it to slow production of its best-selling A320 jets. The latest setback in its efforts to capitalize on a post-pandemic rush for new aircraft. The world's number one plane maker has struggled to source everything from seats to toilets in recent years, making it difficult for the company to assemble and deliver its planes to customers on schedule. However, while Airbus has previously been open about its frustrations with suppliers, it has broadly attributed delays to post-pandemic stresses across the supply chain. On Thursday, it was more pointed, accusing Pratt of failing to meet its contractual commitments for this year and next. "We see shortages of engines from Pratt & Whitney not matching our needs nor our orders," Airbus Chief Executive Guillaume Faury said on a call with analysts. As a result, the company has had to significantly reduce its internal delivery plans, he said. Airbus now forecasts roughly 870 commercial aircraft deliveries this year. That is an increase from the 793 planes it dispatched in 2025, but below the 907 deliveries that analysts had expected for 2026, according to estimates from Visible Alpha. The company said it expects to produce between 70 and 75 A320 aircraft a month by the end of next year, down from its previous target of 75. Faury said the dispute with Pratt was down to the U.S. company's decision to send more engines to airlines to help keep existing aircraft flying instead of providing turbines for new deliveries. Pratt's engine, based on a new geared technology, has had persistent durability issues, which have been compounded by quality problems with some components. Airbus has now triggered a dispute clause in its contract with the engine maker, a subsidiary of RTX, Faury said, declining to elaborate further. "They are not respecting their contractual obligations, so we want to enforce our rights. And indeed, we have initiated a process," Faury told reporters Thursday. A spokesman for Pratt referred to comments from RTX CEO Christopher Calio last month, noting that engine deliveries rose 50% last year compared with pre-pandemic levels. "We're always going to try to support our customers," Calio said on a January 24th earnings call. "There's a balance that we've got to bring to bear given what's going on with the fleet." Airbus has faced years of supply chain disruptions, leading the company to trim its aircraft delivery goal in 2022, 2024, and 2025. Its latest setback comes as rival Boeing is regaining momentum. The U.S. company is now increasing its own production rates after years of manufacturing mishaps and has made early progress recouping some of the market share lost to Airbus in recent years. Airbus issued its downbeat forecast delivery alongside fourth quarter earnings. Airbus said revenue for the 3 months to the end of December climbed 5% to 25.98 billion euro, or about $30.61 billion. Net profit rose 6% to 2.58 billion euro. And let's move from airplane discussions into Nestle's and see what they have going on today. Nestle plans to sell its ice cream business. Article by Amy Look and Margot Patrick. Nestle said it would offload its remaining ice cream business and pull back from a raft of brands as part of a broader plan to revive the packaged food giant's fortunes. The maker of Kit Kat chocolate bars and Nescafe coffee is pursuing a turnaround under new chief executive Philip Navratil after a string of setbacks, weaker-than-expected results, and management upheaval in recent years. On Thursday, Navratil said the Swiss company would recognize around four categories, coffee, pet care, nutrition, and food, in a bid to better adapt to changing customer tastes and reduce costs. As part of its overhaul, Nestle set a plan to sell its remaining ice cream operations to its Froneri joint venture, in which it keeps a 50% stake. Nestle set up with Froneri with private equity firm PAI Partners in 2016 to house some of its ice cream brands, including Häagen-Dazs. Nestle also said it has started talks to offload its waters and premium beverages arm, which houses brands including Perrier and San Pellegrino. Companies across the food and drink industry are reshaping their portfolios to play up their strengths and shed less popular brands as consumer habits shift. Unilever has spun off its ice cream business, forming Magnum Ice Cream, while Keurig Dr. Pepper plans to separate its coffee and beverage units. Investors had eagerly anticipated the scheduled update from Nestle on Thursday for clues to the company's future direction under Navratil. The former Nespresso boss took the job at Nestle in September after former CEO Laurent Freeks was ousted over an undisclosed romantic relationship with a subordinate. Nestle had previously signaled that some of its business could be on the block and launched strategic reviews of its vitamins and water units before Navratil took the helm. The new CEO has said he wouldn't shy away from looking at new areas to trim and has already set out plans to slash 16,000 jobs. However, Navratil stopped short Thursday of taking steps some investors had wanted. Those include a potential sale of Nestle's roughly 20% stake in cosmetic giant L'Oreal to help repay debt or buy back stock. For Navratil, the L'Oreal stake isn't high on his list of priorities. We are a happy holder, the CEO said Thursday. The start of Navratil's tenure has been marred by a crisis in its infant formula business after a contaminated ingredient from a supplier prompted recalls. What began as a precautionary recall due to the presence of cellulide bacteria, a toxin that can cause nausea and vomiting in infants, has ballooned into a full-blown crisis, affecting products in more than 60 countries. Navratil said in a call with reporters that the recall was complete and that the company was running factories around the clock to keep up with supply. However, Nestle said it expected the infant formula recall to weigh on sales growth this year. It forecast organic sales growth of 3 to 4%, including a 0.2% percentage point hit from the recall. For the fourth quarter, Nestle reported organic sales growth of 4%, driven both by higher prices and volumes. This beat analyst estimates of 3.4%, according to a consensus compiled by the company. Overall sales for 2025 came in at 89.49 billion Swiss francs, equivalent to about $115.75 billion dollars. And I think we might have one more article in the business and finance section before we move on. Let's check this one out. Blue Owl sale spurs private credit fear. Article by Matt Wirtz. Wall Street has been eagerly selling private credit as a hot opportunity for individual investors. That sales pitch just got tougher. Blue Owl Capital, a poster child for the industry, said it is liquidating $1.4 billion in assets to raise money to pay out individuals who bought into some of its funds in their heyday but now want to get out. The firm hoped the sale would shore up wobbling investor confidence. Instead, the opposite happened. Stocks across the private fund industry slid as the deal raised questions about how much fund managers can count on individuals to stay invested in hard-to-sell assets for the long term. Blue Owl stock dropped 10% at one point Thursday and closed down 5.9%. Shares of other private credit titans also sank, with Apollo Global Management down 5.2% and Blackstone down 5.4%. Right now, it's reducing confidence and reducing what anyone is willing to pay for these stocks or assets, said Evercore senior research analyst Glenn Shore. Private credit funds use client money to make loans, largely to junk-rated companies, earning hefty interest payments that are handed out to investors through dividends. Stocks of these fund managers soared in recent years, in part on optimism that they could raise trillions of dollars from individual investors. That is already happening through funds targeting wealthy investors, like the Blue Owl one that is under pressure. And the industry is taking steps to make private fund investments available through 401k savings plans. But the Blue Owl sale adds to a growing body of evidence of a disconnect between fund managers and individual investors. In private credit, firms buy harder-to-sell assets for longer periods, with the understanding their clients will be willing to stomach some turbulence in the middle. Individual investors, however, are accustomed to trading out of investments whenever they choose. There are other signs that individuals are souring. There are other signs that individuals are souring, including a jump in redemption requests at the end of 2025. More worrying to stock analysts. The flow of new investments that were expected to fuel future earnings growth is also slowing. Inflows to semi-liquid business development companies, or BDCs, that Blue Owl and others have sold aggressively to wealthy individuals dropped an average 15% over the last 3 months, according to research firm Fitch Ratings. Monthly inflows to the largest such fund, which is managed by Blackstone, dropped to $600 million in January from $1.1 billion in November. And we're going to move to the front page of the Wall Street Journal with this this article. Walmart loses its crown, its U.S. crown, as top company by revenue. Article by Sarah Nassauer and Sean McClain. For nearly two decades, Walmart has been the country's largest company by revenue, a status it touted to prospective hires, employees, and its suppliers. It called itself a Fortune 1 company. On Thursday, Walmart lost its crown. Amazon.com, a 31-year-old company, surpassed 63-year-old Walmart as the country's largest company by annual revenue. Walmart had $713.2 billion in sales in the year through January 31st, compared with Amazon's $716.9 billion for its most recent full year, a narrow difference that has been years in the making. It marks the rapid rise of Amazon from its beginnings as an online bookseller started in Jeff Bezos' garage to a behemoth seeking to dominate sectors from cloud computing, artificial intelligence, and entertainment to online sales. For Walmart, it highlights the reality that Amazon sales are growing faster than its own. Last year, Amazon sales grew 12.4%, while Walmart clocked 4.7% growth. As Amazon grew over decades, Walmart had to change its business model to adapt, said Bill Simon, former Walmart U.S. chief executive through 2014. In that way, Walmart was driving the bus, and now they are riding the bus, Simon said. Walmart leadership prepared for years to lose the title, according to people familiar with the matter. Some were surprised it didn't happen faster. Top executives reframed the company's goals to more often focus on becoming America's favorite place to shop, rather than the biggest or growing fast. At the company's start of the year meeting for store leadership last week in Houston, signage promoted the idea of being the favorite. In past job listings, Walmart often touted the idea that working for the Fortune 1 company was a perk, a reference to its place atop the Fortune 500. Most of its job listings appear to have been scrubbed of the term. A spokeswoman for Walmart declined to comment. Amazon declined to comment on surpassing Walmart in revenue, but a spokeswoman said the company delivered its fastest speeds in 2025, and 100 million people ordered items for same-day delivery. Walmart held the title as the biggest company by revenue since 2001, when it stole the accolade from ExxonMobil. For years, the two companies jockeyed for the bragging rights until 2009, when Walmart claimed it every year until now. I'll say the pace of change in retail is accelerating, Walmart CEO John Furner told analysts on Thursday. For Walmart, the future is fast, convenient, and personalized. Amazon has steadily grown as it funneled cash into its online business, adding new categories of goods, including high-ticket items like luxury handbags and cars. That helped grow sales of many of those categories faster than Walmart. The online retail giant is investing $4 billion to build a network of same-day delivery hubs in rural America. Last year, Amazon added same-day grocery delivery in more than 2,300 towns because it found speedier delivery times lead to more frequent shopping by customers. These investments helped Amazon build market share. As of last fall, it accounted for about 9% of total U.S. retail spending, according to data from PYMNTS Intelligence, a research firm. That is a leap from its pre-pandemic percentage of about 6%. Walmart accounts for about 7.6% of total retail spending, said the firm, about steady with its pre-pandemic percentage. Kevin Matthew was in the market for a Hyundai Elantra N, a sporty version of the four-door sedan last February, when he decided to give Amazon fledgling auto sales program a try. I was done in 30 minutes, top to bottom, the 37-year-old Houston resident said. When was the last time you bought a car in less than an hour? Other than produce and some specialty items, Matthew said he buys nearly everything from his Amazon, to the point that he is worried he is becoming addicted to the convenience. When he goes to hardware stores for his new home, Matthew said he often wonders whether he could have waited a day and got it cheaper on Amazon. The two behemoths have long tried to chip away at each other's turf. In recent years, Walmart grew its selection of marketplace sellers and items, as well as expanded same-day delivery service to 95% of U.S. households. As the country's largest grocer, it continues to grow its share of that category online and off. Around 72% of U.S. households reported purchasing groceries at Walmart over the past month, according to a December survey of 2,000 people from data science firm Dunnhumby. That was a 6 percentage point rise from the previous year's survey and the highest percentage increase since the firm started tracking the metric in 2022. Amazon has struggled to solidify a winning grocery strategy. Earlier this year, Amazon closed dozens of physical stores aimed at growing its grocery business, but it is still growing slowly in the category. An Amazon representative said half of the items ordered by its Prime subscribers for same or next day delivery were groceries and everyday essentials. The company said it would build new Whole Foods Market stores, and it plans to build a giant retail outlet in the Chicago area that will sell groceries and other items, mimicking Walmart's store model. Their profit models are different, but converging. Amazon earns much of its profit from non-retail operations such as cloud computing and advertising, while grabbing retail market share with its fast shipping. Walmart gets the bulk of its sales and profits from U.S. stores, while growing online and through new businesses like advertising and membership income. And we'll move into the U.S. news section of today's Wall Street Journal with this article. Imports hit record amid trade upheaval, article by Matt Grossman. Imports to the U.S. grew to a record high in 2025, leaving the trade deficit little changed despite steep Trump administration tariffs aimed at closing trade gaps. The nation's trade deficit, the gap between imports and exports in both goods and services, was $901.5 billion last year, slightly smaller than the $903.5 billion deficit recorded in 2024, the Commerce Department said Thursday. The small change shows America's role as a heavy net importer remains intact, at least thus far, despite seismic policy shifts during the year. There were big swings in trade patterns along the way, however, including an early year surge in imports as companies tried to get ahead of new tariffs. That surge rapidly reversed after some of the tariffs were rolled back and businesses adjusted to the new trade regime. Overall, imports last year were $4.334 trillion, up about 5% from the prior record of $4.136 trillion in 2024. Exports were $3.432 trillion, up about 6% year over year. Worldwide tariffs rolled out by the Trump administration in April were designed in part to target the trade imbalance in goods specifically. The trade deficit in goods last year rose to a record $1.241 trillion, up from $1.215 trillion in 2024. Last year ended with another big swing. The monthly trade deficit surged to $70.3 billion, up 33% from $53 billion in November and continuing a climb from October, when the deficit briefly sank to its lowest level of the year. Analysts polled by the Wall Street Journal were expecting to see a $55.5 billion December deficit. As in many recent months, outsized swings in international gold trading fueled much of December's trend, as volatility in financial trading for the metal has given rise to more cross-border movement of gold bars. There was a $7.1 billion decrease in U.S. gold exports that month versus November. causing overall exports to fall slightly to $287.3 billion. Meanwhile, U.S. imports in December rose by 3.6% to $357.6 billion, driven in part by more U.S. buying of digital equipment from overseas. Imports of computer accessories grew by $3.4 billion, and imports of telecommunications equipment increased by $1.3 billion, contributing to an overall $10.2 billion increase in goods imports. December capped a rocky 12 months for U.S. trade patterns. The trade deficit soared in the months following President Trump's re-election in late 2024 as companies raced to bring foreign goods onshore ahead of the tariffs they expected him to impose. Then, when the first big wave of those tariffs landed in April, the trade deficit contracted sharply before returning to more typical levels in the second half of the year when some of the tariffs were rolled back. Overall, last year, the tariffs did little to dissuade Americans from importing, with goods and services purchased from overseas little change from levels seen during the Biden administration. Goods imports for 2025 totaled $3.44 trillion last year, about 4% greater than in 2024. And we have an article in the business news section that I hope you might enjoy. Soft sales. A soft U.S.-China sales hurt Pernod. Article by Joshua Kirby. Pernod Ricard said it is focused on cost control after weakening sales in the U.S. and Chinese markets bit into the distiller's earnings. The French maker of Absolut Vodka, Jameson Irish Whiskey, and Martell Cognac booked a 19% drop in its operating profit in the 6 months through December, the first half of its fiscal year, it said in an earnings update Thursday. Sliding sales in the U.S. and Canada in Chinese markets weighed on the group's overall top line, offsetting encouraging signs of smaller but growing markets like India and Turkey. Total revenue for the first half was 15% lower on year at 5.25 euro. A billion euro, or $6.19 billion, a drop that included a big hit from currency effects. A weaker dollar weighed, and the Indian rupee and Turkish lira also hit Pernod's top line. American drinkers spent 15% less over the first half, Pernod said, pointing to a gloomy market for spirits in the U.S., Growing health consciousness and tighter purse strings have kept Americans away from bars and liquor stores, a trend also highlighted in recent earnings updates from brewers like Bud Light producer Anheuser-Busch InBev and Dutch group Heineken. In China, meanwhile, Pernod sales dropped by an even sharper 28%. A tougher regulatory environment restrained sales of high-end spirits at bars and restaurants, while general consumer weakness also hit revenue, Pernod said. Still, some brands, including Absolut and Jameson, booked good growth in China over the period, the company said. In light of the falling sales, Pernod is focused on boosting cash generation and cutting costs through efficiency measures, Chief Executive Officer Alexander Ricard said. I remain confident in the attractive fundamentals of our industry, Pernod Ricard's strategy, and the resilience of our operating model to deliver sustainable value over time, Ricard said. For the remainder of the fiscal year, Pernod said it expects improving trends in sales, but noted that fiscal 2026 is a transition year. We will defend our organic operating margin to the fullest extent possible, supported by strict cost control, the company said. The group has previously sent out a midterm plan to save 1 billion euro through operational efficiencies, one-third of which will be made this fiscal year, it said. For the medium term, Pernod is targeting organic sales growth of 3 to 6% and a wider operating margin. And there's a section that appears occasionally in the Wall Street Journal. It's called the Workplace Technology section. Here's an article I hope you find interesting. Workers are afraid that AI will take their jobs. They're missing the bigger danger. Article by Matthew Call, It isn't whether artificial intelligence is going to replace them. It's who will control the knowledge that companies capture from their employees. Walk into any corporate office and you'll hear the same anxious conversation. Will AI eliminate white-collar jobs? The optimists insist that new jobs will emerge to replace the ones we lose. After all, it has happened in previous tech revolutions. Pragmatists argue the workforce will simply become more productive with artificial intelligence, creating more value with minimal job cuts. And the pessimists fear entry-level knowledge workers will become obsolete altogether. But this debate misses a crucial dynamic. Right now, workers are potentially training AI how to make them obsolete, and they don't often realize it. The kind of AI used by companies called an enterprise AI system can capture everything you do at work and use that information to train itself. These systems can record your interactions within the platform, the prompts you write, the documents you create, the queries you run. In other words, the company can potentially track and claim ownership of every keystroke you make within the system, every idea you document there, every tool you build using that platform. It can identify what approaches work best and what email language. I had a little glitch there. Get responses and how you approach those clients. And all that knowledge can become part of the company AI. So it may eventually know, down to increasingly fine details, how you do your work. Then comes the dangerous part for employees. The AI can pass that information along to anybody else who does your job, or in some cases, just do the job itself. Over time, you could become a lot less valuable to your employer and a lot more replaceable. The dynamic may fundamentally change the relationship between employer and employee. The stakes are so high and so urgent that both sides are rushing to position or protect themselves. Executives are rapidly implementing enterprise AI systems, seeking productivity gains and competitive advantage. And they often aren't disclosing the implications for job security and privacy. Meanwhile, at least some employees are secretly adopting personal AI tools, sometimes violating corporate policies, so that their employers can't capture everything they know and do. Capturing the essence. To understand what's coming, you need to understand what enterprise AI systems actually are. These are different from the interfaces you use at home. Enterprise AI systems are platforms that integrate directly into corporate workflows. Think of Microsoft Copilot, embedded in Word, Excel, and Outlook, or Salesforce's Einstein AI woven into customer relation management. These systems sit inside the tools where you already work, and they could potentially capture much of your work within the platform, learning from many interactions and embedding that knowledge into company-owned infrastructure. What once lived only in employees' heads, built through years of experience and hard-won expertise, is increasingly being institutionalized in real time. When you leave, at least some of your knowledge stays behind, embedded in systems that will be used by the AI and by your replacement, if a replacement is needed at all. Imagine that you are a senior software engineer debugging a system crash. You run a bunch of tests to figure out the problem, and when you discover the solution isn't in the documentation, you develop a novel workaround. You share the solution with the company, obviously, but the expertise and techniques that you brought to the platform were all yours in a fundamental way. You figured out the workaround because of what you know and how you work. That is the way things used to be anyway. When you do your work through enterprise AI, though, the system doesn't just record your solution. It can capture your problem-solving approach, which questions you asked first, how you refined the search when initial attempts failed, potentially even the logical steps that led you from symptom to cause. The next time junior engineers face a similar crash, the system may be able to guide them through elements of the methodology you used. You haven't lost your expertise, but now the employer also has access to key aspects of that expertise in a form it controls and can deploy to other employees without you. It has a partial blueprint for how you think. and some of the knowledge that once made you indispensable is now a reproducible company asset. Making it personal. These revolutionary changes seem to put workers in a tight spot, but I believe employees have an alternative, one that isn't easy, but could help move the power dynamic back in their favor. Specifically, employees should consider avoiding their company AI systems when possible and use personal AI tools like ChatGPT, Claude, Gemini, Copilot, or dozens of others. These tools operate on completely different terms than enterprise AI. You access them directly. You own your prompts, your workflows, your customizations. The knowledge you create stays with you. Most critically, when you walk out the door, your AI-enhanced capabilities walk with you. Maybe you're required to use the company's enterprise AI for client work, but all the strategic thinking you do before engaging with clients, develop that using personal AI tools. I spoke with a regional vice president at an energy company who does exactly that. He uses his firm's enterprise system for required compliance and documentation, but develops new analytical approaches and tests complex decisions in personal AI tools. The novel insights stay his. Using personal AI tools is just the first step employees should take, however. To really change the power dynamic, they can act on other fronts. Negotiate up front. When joining a company, people should treat access to AI tools like intellectual property ownership. Most employment agreements cover IP created on the job, but employees should dig further into a company's policy before signing on. What gets captured through enterprise AI? How long is that data retained? Can you use personal AI tools for skill development? Can you request deletion of your contributions if you leave? Most companies haven't thought through these questions yet, which means there is room to establish reasonable boundaries before you're locked in. Support collective action. Individual opt-out of AI is often impossible, so unions and professional associations need to pay attention. With collective bargaining, workers could demand transparency about the use of enterprise AI and demand fair compensation for the knowledge it gathers. Without collective power, individual employees will keep clicking accept on agreements that restructure their jobs simply because they have no alternative. Concerned employee action may start to change the AI calculus. Employers may find that enterprise AI systems do capture knowledge, but at a steep cost. They may drive away the most talented employees, ones who realize they can build more valuable, portable capabilities with personal tools. AI is breaking the traditional model of employment in real time faster than anyone realizes. The companies and employees who understand these dynamics will position themselves to capture AI benefits. Those who don't may find themselves on the losing side of the biggest workplace shift in a generation. And I think we have a time for at least one more article. Let's move to the opinion pages of today's Wall Street Journal. The embarrassing truth about tariffs. This is the review and outlook column that appears regularly in the Wall Street Journal. The White House this week opened a new front on its war on the Federal Reserve, a fight about Fed research on the consequences of President Trump's tariffs. If the tariffs are such an unambiguous economic and political winner, why is the administration so defensive about them? The flap concerns the analysis we told you about last week by four economists at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. They found that American households and businesses are bearing nearly 90% of the cost of the Trump tariffs, contrary to Mr. Trump's claim that foreigners will pay. Clearly, the White House is worried there that voters might conclude this research aligns with their own experience. Kevin Hassett, director of the National Economic Council, took to CNBC Wednesday to pan the New York Fed research as the worst paper I have ever seen in the history of the Federal Reserve System, and suggested the people who wrote and published it should be disciplined. Disciplined how? Put in stocks? For a tariff paper? The Fed analysis aligns with other research into the distribution of tariff costs from Harvard economists and Germany's Kiel Institute, and with common sense. There isn't widespread evidence that foreign producers are cutting their prices to offset the tariffs, the main mechanism by which foreigners would pay for the border taxes. Nor is the dollar strengthening, which is the other possible mechanism for making foreigners pay. We'll spare you the equations. Instead, the tariffs are causing an increase in post-tariff prices of those goods that are still imported, alongside a modest decrease in the volume of imports. Americans pay higher prices or pay in the form of less choice. In his more honest moments, Mr. Trump admits this is the effect, if not the intention, of his tariffs. That's what he meant when he said last year that Americans may have to pay a few dollars for their children, have to buy fewer dolls for their children as a result of his trade policies. The handful of economists who support the tariffs believe the border taxes rebalance the global economy specifically by deterring American consumption. The Fed research and similar papers try to put some numbers on these phenomena. The serious kernel of Mr. Hassett's complaint, to the extent there is one, is that the New York Fed economists overlooked a wide range of other ways the tariffs could affect the U.S. economy, such as stimulating reshoring of production and an increase in domestic wages. But such an analysis also probably would flatter the Trump tariffs. So far, the manufacturing boom Mr. Trump promised hasn't appeared, as manufacturing jobs are down over the last year. The New York Fed and other research on cost distribution shows one reason why. To the extent American companies eat some of the cost of tariffs, that's less cash available for investment and hiring. The Trump economy has been as healthy as it is despite the tariffs, not because of them. The market response to his April 2025 liberation tariffs was so negative that the president quickly withdrew them and negotiated lower tariffs as part of trade deals that may turn out to be partly illusory. He has also laced the tariffs with multiple exemptions, a dollop of tax reform, a big dose of deregulation, and an AI investment boom are allowing the economy to cope with the tariff distortions and uncertainty. The attack on the Fed over this research is a symptom of the political problem the White House is encountering from tariffs. 13 months into Mr. Trump's term, and with elections looming, opinion polls show voters remain worried about the economy. This implies they don't see a payoff from the tariffs other than what they're paying at the store. And folks, that brings us to the end of the Wall Street Journal this morning on February 20th, 2026. This is Steve of the Talking Information Center. It's been my pleasure reading the Wall Street Journal for you today. Have a wonderful weekend.